Thank you, Ron. I have certain things to turn on first. All right? I've just turned on myself. That's a little bit unusual, anyway. Sorry about that. First of all, it's a real pleasure to be here, where the air is fresh and the people are friendly and the culture is civilized and normal. Or relatively so. I nevertheless give you greetings from Manhattan and from Greenwich Village, where we live. It's a very different world in some respects, but maybe it's not as different as we all think. Tonight I'm going to be talking about the psychology of unbelief, the psychology of atheism, or what might also be called the psychology of those who reject God. In doing this, my major point is to show that one of the criticisms of Christianity can be clearly rebutted. That criticism is that people who believe in God for psychologically unacceptable reasons. I'm sure we've all heard the idea that if you believe in God, it's because you have childish and immature needs, probably of an unconscious kind, that go back to your infancy or your childhood in any case. And it's because of these needs for security, these needs for hope, these needs for understanding, that you believe in God. Now that argument we'll be discussing tonight. But what I want to show is that this argument can be applied also to the unbeliever. That it's not just believers who might have psychological reasons for believing in God. It is also the case that unbelievers have psychological reasons for rejecting God. And when we're through looking at some of those reasons and some of the people who I think exemplify them, I hope we will all agree that in the future, the reasons that we have for believing in God or for not believing in God, the psychological reasons, should be taken off the table as not relevant to discussion. And that it's not just the believer, as I said, who has reasons for belief, although no one's shown that yet, but the unbeliever also has psychological reasons of great, in my judgment, great interest for why they reject God. And with that as a preamble, let me begin. The title of my talk tonight, The Psychology of Atheism, may seem strange to some of you. Certainly my psychological colleagues have found it odd, and even, I might add, a little disturbing. After all, psychology since its founding roughly a century ago has often focused on the opposite topic, namely the psychology of religious belief. Indeed, in many respects, the origins of modern psychology are intimately bound up with the psychologists who explicitly proposed interpretations of belief in God. William James and Sigmund Freud, for example, were both personally and professionally deeply involved in the topic. Recall The Will to Believe by James, as well as his famous Varieties of Religious Experience. These two works are devoted to an attempt to understanding belief as the result of psychological, that is, natural causes. James himself might have been quite sympathetic to religion, but his own position, at least his public position, was one of doubt. And his writings were part of psychology's general undermining of religious faith. As for Sigmund Freud, his critiques of religion, in particular Christianity, are well known, and we will discuss them in some detail later. For now, it is enough to remember how deeply involved Freud and his thought have been with the question of God and religion. Given the close involvement between the founding of much of psychology and critical interpretations of religion, it should not be surprising that most psychologists view with some alarm any attempt to propose a psychology of unbelief or of atheism. At the very least, such a project puts many psychologists on the defensive and gives them some taste, if you might say, of their own medicine. Psychologists are always observing and interpreting others, and it is time that some of them learn from their own personal experience what it is like to be put under the microscope of psychological theory and experiment. Regardless, I hope to show that the psychological concepts used quite effectively to interpret religion are two-edged swords that can also be used to interpret atheism. Sauce for the believer is equally sauce for the unbeliever. Before beginning, however, I wish to make two points bearing on the underlying assumptions of my remarks. First, I assume that the major barriers to belief in God are not rational, but in a general sense can be called psychological. I am quite convinced that for every person strongly swayed by rational argument, there are countless others more affected by non-rational psychological factors. The human heart, no one can truly fathom it or know all its deceits, but at least it is the proper task of the psychologist to try. Thus, to begin, I propose that intense, often unconscious psychological barriers to belief in God are of great importance. What some of these might be, I will mention shortly. For believers, therefore, it is important to keep in mind that psychological motives and pressures that one is unaware of often lie behind unbelief. One of the earliest theorists of the unconscious, St. Paul, wrote, "I can will what is right, but I cannot do it. I see in my members another law at war with the law of my mind." Thus, it seems to me sound theology, as well as good psychology, that psychological factors can be impediments to belief as well as to behavior, and that these may often be unconscious factors as well. Further, as a corollary, it is reasonable to propose that people vary greatly in the extent to which these factors are present in their lives. Some of us have been blessed with an upbringing, a temperament, social environment, and other gifts that have made belief in God a much easier thing than many who have suffered more or who have been raised in a spiritually impoverished environment or have had other difficulties with which to cope. Scripture makes it clear that many children, even into the third or fourth generation, suffer from the sins of their fathers, including the sins of fathers who may have been believers. In short, my first point is that some people have much more serious psychological barriers to belief than others, a point consistent with Scripture's clear statement that we are not to judge others, however much we are to correct evil. My second point as a qualification is that in spite of serious difficulties to belief, all of us still have a free choice to accept God or reject Him. This qualification is not in contradiction to the first. For example, one person, as a consequence of his or her particular past or present environment, may find it much harder than most people to believe in God. But presumably at any moment, certainly at many times, a person can choose to move toward God or to move away. One man might start with so many barriers that even after years of slowly choosing to move toward God, he may still not be there. Some may die before they reach belief. We assume they will be judged, like all of us, on how far they traveled toward God and how well they loved others, on how well they did with what they had. Likewise, another man without any serious psychological difficulties is still free to reject God, and no doubt many do. Thus, although the ultimate issue is one of the will and of our sinful nature, it is still possible to investigate those psychological factors that predispose one to unbelief, that make the road to belief in God especially long and difficult. Now, first, I want to begin with what I call the simple or the shallow reasons for being an atheist. There seems to be a widespread assumption throughout much of the Western intellectual community that belief in God is based on all kinds of irrational, immature needs and wishes, but that atheism or skepticism is derived from a rational, no-nonsense appraisal of the way things really are. To begin a critique of this assumption, I start with my own case history. As some of you may know, after a rather weak, wishy-washy Christian upbringing, I became an atheist in college in the 1950s and remained so throughout graduate school and my first years as a young experimental psychologist on the faculty at NYU. That is, I'm an adult convert, or more technically, a reconvert to Christianity, who came back to the faith, much to his surprise, in his late 30s in the very secular environment of academic psychology in New York City. I'm not going into this to bore you with parts of my life story, but to note that through reflection on my own experience, it is now clear to me that my reasons for becoming and remaining an atheist skeptic from about age 18 to 38 were superficial, irrational, and largely without serious intellectual or moral justification. Furthermore, I'm convinced that my shallow motives were and still are commonplace today among intellectuals, academics, scientists, artists, and so forth. The major factors in my becoming an atheist, although I wasn't really aware of them at the time, were as follows. The first factor I call general socialization. An important influence on me in my youth was a significant social unease. I was somewhat embarrassed to be from the Midwest, for it seemed to me terribly dull, narrow, and provincial. There was certainly nothing romantic or impressive about being from Cincinnati, Ohio, and from a vague mixed German, English, Swiss background. Terribly middle class. Further, besides escape from a dull and, according to me, unworthy and socially inadequate past, I wanted to take part in fact, to be comfortable in the new, exciting, glamorous secular world into which I was moving. I'm sure that similar motives have strongly influenced the lives of countless upwardly mobile young people in the last two centuries. Consider Voltaire, who moved into the glittering, aristocratic, sophisticated world of Paris, and who always felt embarrassed about his provincial and non-aristocratic origin. Or the Jewish ghettos that so many assimilating Jews have fled. Or today, the latest young arrival in New York City, probably Soho or Tribeca, embarrassed about his fundamentalist parents. This kind of socialization pressure has pushed many away from belief in God and all that this belief is associated with for them. I remember a small seminar in graduate school where almost every member there at some time expressed this kind of embarrassment and response to the pressures of socialization into modern and secular life. One student was trying to escape his Southern Baptist background, another a small-town Mormon environment, a third was trying to get out of a very Jewish Brooklyn ghetto, and the fourth was me. That's general socialization. Now I'm going to mention specific socialization. Another reason for my wanting to become an atheist was that I desired to be accepted by the powerful and influential scientists in the field of psychology. In particular, I wanted to be accepted by my professors in graduate school. As a graduate student, I was thoroughly socialized by the specific culture of academic research psychology. My professors at Stanford, however much they might disagree on psychological theory, were, as far as I could tell, united in only two things: their intense personal career ambition and their rejection of religion. As the psalmist says, the man greedy for gain curses and renounces the Lord. All his thoughts are, there is no God. In this environment, just as I learned how to dress like a student by putting on the right clothes, I also learned to think like a proper psychologist by putting on the right, that is, atheistic and skeptical ideas and attitudes. Finally, I want to list one other shallow reason, but important reason for becoming an atheist. Here I must list simple personal convenience. The fact is that it is quite inconvenient to be a serious believer in today's powerful neo-pagan world. I would have had to give up many pleasures and a good deal of time. Without going into details, it is not hard to imagine the sexual pleasures that would have to be rejected if I became a serious believer. And then I also knew it would cost me time and some money. There would be church services, church groups, time for prayer and scripture reading, time spent helping others. I was already too busy. Obviously, becoming religious would be a real inconvenience. Now, perhaps you think that such reasons are restricted to especially callow young men, like me in my 20s. However, such reasoning is not so restricted. Here I will take up the case of Mortimer Adler, a well-known American philosopher, writer, and intellectual who has spent much of his life thinking about God and religious topics. One of his most recent books is titled How to Think About God, A Guide for the 20th Century Pagan. In this work, Adler presses the argument for the existence of God very strongly, and by the latter chapters, he is close to accepting the living God. Yet he pulls back and remains among the vast company of the religiously uncommitted. But Adler leaves the impression that his decision is more one of will than of intellect. As one of his reviewers notes, Adler confirms this impression in his autobiography, Philosopher at Large. There, while investigating his reasons for twice stopping short of full religious commitment, he writes that the answer, quote, lies in the state of one's will, not in the state of one's mind. Adler goes on to comment that to become seriously religious, quote, would require a radical change in my way of life, and, quote, the simple truth of the matter is that I do not wish to live up to being a genuinely religious person. There you have it, a remarkably honest and conscious admission that being a genuinely religious person would be too much trouble, too inconvenient. I can't but assume that such are the shallow reasons behind many an unbeliever's position. In summary, because of my social needs to assimilate, because of my professional needs to be accepted as an academic psychologist, and because of my personal needs for a convenient lifestyle, for all of these needs, atheism was simply the best policy. I now want to go to the deeper reasons for being an atheist. I think these reasons that I've just mentioned may be the most common by far. But nevertheless, there are a significant number of people for whom atheism is not something as shallow or superficial as I've just mentioned. And I want to now talk about some of the deeper reasons why somebody might reject God. And I would like to begin with the psychology of atheism in a psychoanalytic framework. Yes, psychoanalysis is still alive and well in New York City. So I'm going to give you a little bit of it. First, I want to point out that the Freudian criticism of belief in God, as I've already mentioned, is that such a belief is untrustworthy because of its psychological origin. That is, God is a projection of our own intense unconscious desires. He is a wish fulfillment derived from childish needs for protection and security. Since these wishes are largely unconscious, any denial of them is to be given little credence. It should be noted that in developing this kind of critique, Freud raised the ad hominem argument to one of wide influence. It is in The Future of an Illusion that he makes his position clearest. Quote, religious ideas have arisen from the same needs as have all the other achievements of civilization, from the necessity of defending oneself against the crushing superior force of nature. Therefore, religious beliefs are illusions, fulfillments of the oldest, strongest, and most urgent wishes of mankind. As we already know, the terrifying impression of helplessness in childhood aroused the need for protection through love, which was provided by the Father. Thus, the benevolent rule of a divine providence allays our fear of the dangers of life. End of Freud's quote. Let us look at this argument. In the first paragraph, Freud fails to note that his arguments against religious beliefs are, in his own words, equally valid against all the achievements of civilization, including psychoanalysis. That is, if the psychic origin of an intellectual achievement invalidates its truth value, then physics, biology, literature, and the arts, much less psychoanalysis itself, are vulnerable to the same charge. In the second paragraph, Freud makes another strange claim, namely that the oldest and most urgent wishes of mankind are for the loving, protecting guidance of a powerful father, for divine providence. However, if these wishes were as strong and as ancient as he claims, one would expect pre-Christian religion to have strongly emphasized God as a benevolent father. In general, this was not the case for the pagan religions of the Mediterranean world, and for example, it is still not the case for such popular religions as Buddhism and for much of Hinduism. Indeed, Judaism, and most especially Christianity, are in many respects distinctive in this emphasis. However, let us put these two serious intellectual gaffes aside and turn to another understanding of the projection theory. First, it can be shown that this theory is not, in fact, a part of psychoanalysis. It gains no support from psychoanalysis in terms of its theoretical linkages. It's essentially an autonomous or independent argument. And there are two reasons for being able to state this as the case. First, Freud's critical attitude toward religion is part of his personal predilections, and it's not part of his clinical concepts. Indeed, the argument about autonomy and, you know, things of that kind don't really talk too much to psychoanalytic theory. But the major reason for its autonomy is, first of all, that the argument was clearly stated many decades earlier by Ludwig Feuerbach, and Freud had read and knew these arguments very well. Here are some of the comments by Feuerbach in the 1840s. Sounds very Freudian when you listen to them. What man misses, whether this be an articulate and therefore conscious or an unconscious need, that is his God. Man projects his nature into the world outside himself before he finds it in himself. To live in projected dream images is the essence of religion. Religion sacrifices reality to the projected dream. So we can see the argument was clearly first formulated by Feuerbach, and what Freud did was to write it up much later when there was a wider audience for this kind of thought and to implicitly give it the endorsement of psychoanalysis, something, however, which really doesn't follow. And of course, another reason for saying this is not part of psychoanalysis is to quote Freud, who says quite distinctly that it is not. Quote, let us be quite clear on the point that my views expressed in my book, The Future of an Illusion, form no part of analytic theory. They are my personal views. So there is no support, really, for the projection theory from psychoanalysis in theory. It's also important to keep in mind that Freud, and these are two things that most people don't know. One, Freud never psychoanalyzed a patient who believed in God at the time of the psychoanalysis, if we use his written written case histories as our evidence. He hardly knew anybody who believed in God. Almost all of his associates did not. And second, to the best of my knowledge, and this I am less certain of, to the best of my knowledge, no one has tested the projection theory of the origin of religious belief in the intervening years in any systematic way to come up with support for it. There may be some support for the psychological basis of belief that is found in this interpretation. There may be. But in any case, we're going to be finding in a minute evidence that the unbeliever also has a psychological rationale for unbelief. So therefore, we want to take the psychological reasons out of the case. They're nevertheless interesting. Now, I believe Freud is quite right to worry that a belief can be an illusion because it derives from powerful wishes, from unconscious childish needs. The irony is that Freud himself clearly provided a very powerful way and a new way to understand the neurotic basis of unbelief. Now here let me give you the psychoanalytic theory of why we should all be unbelievers or atheists. The central concept in much of Freud's work is the well-known Oedipus complex. In the case of male personality development, the essential feature of this complex, the essential features, are as follows. Roughly in the age period 3 to 5 or 3 to 6, the boy develops a strong sexual desire for the mother. At the same time, he develops an intense hatred and fear of the father and a desire to supplant him, a craving for power, as Freud described it. This hatred is based on the boy's knowledge that the father, with his greater size and strength, stands in the way of his desires. The child's fear of the father may explicitly be a fear of castration, but more typically it has a less specific character. The son does not really kill the father, of course, but patricide is assumed to be a common preoccupation of his fantasies and dreams. The resolution of the complex is supposed to occur through the boy's recognition that he cannot replace the father, he's too big, and through fear of castration, which eventually leads the boy to identify with the father, to identify with the aggressor, and to repress the original frightening components of the complex. Now, it's important to keep in mind that, according to Freud, this complex is never truly resolved, and it is capable of activation at later periods, almost always, for example, at puberty, where it shows up in male hostility toward authority figures or other father figures. Thus, the powerful ingredients of murderous hate and of incestuous sexual desire within a family context are never, in fact, removed. Instead, they are covered over and repressed. And this was originally Freud's interpretation of the origin of all of our neuroses as adults. They come out of this thing. Now, obviously, in most cases, this potential is not expressed in any seriously neurotic manner. Instead, it shows up in our attitudes toward authority, in dreams, slips of the tongue, transient irrationalities, etc. Now, in postulating a universal Oedipus complex as the origin of all our neuroses, Freud inadvertently developed a straightforward rationale for understanding the wish-fulfilling origin of rejecting God. After all, the Oedipus complex is unconscious. It is established in childhood, and above all, its dominant motive is hatred of the father and desire for him not to exist, especially as represented by the desire to overthrow or kill him. Freud regularly described God as a psychological equivalent to the father, and so a natural expression of Oedipal motivation would be powerful unconscious desires for the non-existence of God. Therefore, in the Freudian framework, atheism is an illusion caused by the Oedipal desire to kill the father and replace him with oneself. To act as if God does not exist is an obvious, not very subtle disguise for a wish to kill him. Much in the same way as in a dream, the image of a parent going away or disappearing can represent such a wish. God is dead is simply an undisguised Oedipal wish fulfillment. It is certainly not hard to understand the Oedipal character of so much contemporary atheism and skepticism. Hugh Hefner, even James Bond, with their rejection of God, plus their countless young ladies, are so obviously living out Freud's Oedipal and primal rebellion. So are countless other skeptics who live out variations of the same scenario of exploitive sexual relationships combined with narcissistic self-worship. So I hope I've been able to show that you can use the psychoanalytic framework to explain why we should all be atheists. It's an unresolved Oedipus complex. One interesting example of this Oedipal motivation proposed here is that of Voltaire, a leading skeptic about all things religious who denied the Christian and Jewish notion of a personal God, of God as a father. Voltaire was a theist, or deist, who believed in a cosmic, depersonalized God of unknown character. The psychologically important thing about Voltaire is that he strongly rejected his father, so much so that he rejected his father's name and took the name Voltaire. It is not exactly certain where the new name came from, but one widely held interpretation is that it was constructed from the letters of his mother's last name. When Voltaire was in his early 20s, in 1718, he published his first play that was, in fact, publicly performed in Paris. It was quite a success, and the name of that play, Oedipus. The play itself recounts the classic legend with heavy allusions to religious and political rebellion. Throughout his life, Voltaire, like Freud, toyed with the idea that he was not his father's son. He apparently felt the desire to be from a higher, more aristocratic family than his actual background. In short, Voltaire's hostility to his own father, his religious rejection of God the Father, and his political rejection of the king, an acknowledged father figure, are all reflections of the same basic unconscious Oedipal needs. Psychologically speaking, Voltaire's rebellion against his father and against God are therefore easily interpretable as Oedipal wish fulfillment, and according to Freud, therefore, comforting illusions and not attitudes worthy of a mature mind. Diderot, the great encyclopedist and an avowed atheist, indeed he is one of the founding brothers of modern atheism, also had Oedipal preoccupation and insight. Freud approvingly quotes Diderot's anticipatory observation. This is Diderot writing in about 1770 or early 80s. If the little savage was left to himself, preserving all his foolishness and adding to the small sense of a child in the cradle the violent passions of a man of 30, he would strangle his father and lie with his mother, end quote. Freud picked that up, of course, as evidence for his theory. But now, let us continue with still deeper understanding of the psychology of atheism. I am well aware of the fact that there is good reason to give only limited acceptance to the Oedipal theory. In any case, it is my view that although the Oedipus complex is valid for some, a rather small number, the theory is far, far from being a universal representation of unconscious motivation. Since there is need for a deeper understanding of atheism, and since I don't know of any theoretical framework except the Oedipal one, I'm forced to sketch out a model of my own, or really, to develop an undeveloped thesis of Freud. In his essay on Leonardo da Vinci, Freud made the following remark. Psychoanalysis, which has taught us the intimate connection between the father complex and belief in God, has shown us that the personal God is logically nothing but an exalted father, and daily demonstrates to us how youthful persons lose their religious belief as soon as the authority of the father breaks down. This statement makes no assumption about unconscious sexual desires for the mother, or even about presumed universal competitive hatred focused on the father. Instead, it makes the simple, easily understandable claim that once a child or youth is disappointed in and loses his or her respect for their earthly father, then belief in a heavenly father becomes difficult or impossible. There are, of course, many ways that a father can lose his authority and seriously disappoint a child. Some of these ways for which clinical evidence will be given are: one, he can be present, but obviously weak, cowardly, and unworthy of respect. Two, he can be present, but physically, sexually, or psychologically abusive. Three, he can be absent through death or by abandoning or leaving the family. Taken together, these three proposed determinants of unbelief will be called the defective father hypothesis. To support the validity of this approach, I will conclude by providing case history material from the lives of prominent unbelievers, for it was in reading the biographies of atheists that this hypothesis first struck me. We begin with Sigmund Freud's relationship to his own father. That Freud's father, Jakob, was a deep disappointment or worse is generally agreed to by his biographers. Specifically, his father was a weak man, unable to financially provide for his family. Instead, money seems to have been provided by his wife's family and others. Furthermore, Freud's father was passive in response to anti-Semitism. Freud recounts an episode told him by his father in which Jakob allowed an anti-Semite to call him a dirty Jew and to knock his hat off. Young Sigmund, on hearing the story, was mortified at his father's failure to respond. Sigmund Freud was a complex and in many ways ambiguous man, but all agree that he was a courageous fighter and that he greatly admired courage in others. He once said that he says, "I'm not a scientist, I'm an intellectual conquistador." He admired courage in others. Sigmund, as a young man, several times physically stood up against anti-Semitism, and of course he was one of the greatest of intellectual fighters. Jakob's actions as a defective father, however, probably go still deeper. Specifically, in two of his letters as an adult, Freud writes that his father was a sexual pervert and that Jakob's own children suffered from this. There are also other possible moral disasters that we don't have time to note. Now, the connection of Jakob to God and religion was also present to his son. Jakob was involved in a kind of Reform Judaism when Freud was a child, and the two of them spent hours reading the Bible together. And later, Jakob became increasingly involved in reading the Talmud and in discussing Jewish scripture. In short, this weak, rather passive, nice guy, this Schlemiel, was clearly connected to Judaism and God, and also to a serious lack of courage and quite possibly to sexual perversion and other weaknesses, very painful to young Sigmund. Very briefly, other famous atheists seem to have had similar relationships with their father. Ludwig Feuerbach's father did something that could easily have deeply hurt his son. When Feuerbach was about 13, his father left his family and openly took up living with another woman in a different town. This was in Germany in the early 1800s, and such a public rejection would have been a scandal and deeply rejecting to young Ludwig, and of course to his mother and to the other children. After living with this woman, who was the wife of a good friend of his, the father came back when this woman died, and after about 8 years, and lived with the family from then on as though nothing had happened. I mean, think of what pain must have been involved in that. The father himself, who was a very famous jurist, was also described as a volcano. He was the volcano. You never knew when he was going to blow up. Well, Feuerbach had good reasons to be unhappy with his father. Let us jump 100 years or so and look at the life of one of America's best-known atheists, Madeline Murray O'Hare. Here I will quote from her son's book on what life was like in his family when he was a child. The book opens when this boy is 8 years old. Quote, "We rarely did anything together as a family. The hatred between my grandfather and mother barred such wholesome scenes." He writes that he really didn't know why his mother hated her father so much, but hate him she did. For the opening chapter records a very ugly fight in which she attempts to kill her father with a 10-inch butcher knife. Madeline failed but screamed, "I'll see you dead, I'll get you yet, I'll walk on your grave." Here are some other examples. There's a very famous atheist philosopher, an English philosopher. And I mentioned this thesis to a well-known American philosopher named, some of you may know of him, Alvin Plantinga. And Plantinga was at a philosopher's convention somewhere, and there was a party during the convention in the hotel. And this famous atheist philosopher was drunk, and he was on the floor, hitting the floor during the party, saying, "I hate my father, I hate my father, I hate my father." His father was what's called a well-known English divine. That is, his father was a theological writer of an earlier generation. Similar thing is the case with a prominent clinical psychologist named Albert Ellis, who's a very outspoken atheist and disparager of believers. I read this thesis to him in slightly shorter form while he was sitting on a dais like this over here. We were part of a joint conference on theism and atheism, and he went first and read, you know, the atheist position as a psychologist, and I read this thesis. As we walked out, a little bit nervously after the talk, he said, "Well, you know, your thesis, I don't believe it because it's not true for me." And I said, "Well, you know, a thesis like this in psychology, if it's true for a significant proportion of people, that's fine. It's never going to be 100%. People are complicated and varied." Later, when I got back to New York, a friend of mine who was a publisher called me, and I mentioned this talk, and so he said, "Hey, send it up to me. I'd like to read it." So I did. About 2 weeks later, this publisher friend of mine called me on the phone, and he said, "Hey, Paul, I like that paper. By the way, it fits Albert Ellis perfectly." And I said, "How can that be? That can't be. He told me personally, after hearing me read that paper, that he got on fine with his father." So I said, "How can that be?" And he says, "Well, we're publishing his biography. And last night I was reading the page proofs." Well, so when the biography came out, I read the pages about his childhood. And Albert Ellis grew up in New York City in the 1920s and 30s, he and his brother. And they grew up on the streets of New York because they were abandoned by their father, who literally abandoned them when they were around, Albert made about 10. Prior to that, he had shown very little affection. He'd been in the hospital with an illness for a year and only maybe been visited once. His mother had serious mental problems, stayed with the two boys, but she couldn't work or provide any income. So the two boys supported themselves, supported their mother, and put themselves through college. And the father would every now and then meet them, run into them, see them, and then he'd go off. But you can't tell me in the 20s and 30s that if your father abandoned you like that, and then occasionally you saw him around, you wouldn't have a deep resentment, a deep rejection. He did everything on his own. It took a lot of courage and a lot of guts on the part of Albert Ellis. But I would say right now he's buried that long ago. Here are some other interesting case histories. David Hume, really a serious skeptic. His father died at 2. Bertrand Russell's father died when he was 4. Nietzsche's father died when he was 4. Sartre's father died when he was 1.5 years, approximately. Camus' father died slightly before he was born. Schopenhauer, the famous pessimist and atheist, disliked his mother a great deal, who had been very rejecting of him, and rather liked his father. But his father committed suicide when he was 16. And ever after that, he was alone. No wonder he was a pessimist. I know of another case. This is of a woman who her father was the more religious member of her family, and she often went to church with him and liked to go and sit next to him while they sang hymns and so on when she was a little girl. She was also a rather religious girl by temperament. And sometimes they would go to two services. Her father was a very quiet man. She didn't know that he was also deeply depressed. When she was 16, her father committed suicide. She remembers hearing about it, and he used a shotgun. They got the message when she was in high school, and she came home. Well, it was a devastating blow for her family, for her mother. You know, everything just collapsed after that. And within a year, it was only many years later, she noticed that within a year, she had stopped going to church and had become an atheist. This woman's told me I can give this story in public. She happens to be my wife. And when we met, she was a very strong atheist, much more than I. I was sort of a skeptic. And now she recognizes the connection and the link. I suppose it should be clear how the psychology of a dead or non-existent father could lay an emotional base for unbelief. But after all, if one's own father is absent or so weak as to die or so untrustworthy as to desert them, it's not hard to place some of these same attributes on a heavenly father. Finally, of course, there's also the personal experience of suffering, of death, of evil, sometimes combined with anger at God for allowing it to happen. Some of this psychology is captured in Russell Baker's autobiography. Russell Baker is a well-known journalist and humorous writer for the New York Times. His father was taken to the hospital and died there suddenly when young Russell was 5. Baker wept and sorrowed and spoke to the family housekeeper, Bessie. "For the first time, I thought seriously about God. Between sobs, I told Bessie that if God could do things like this to people, then God was hateful and I had no more use for him. Bessie told me about the peace of heaven and the joy of being among the angels and the happiness of my father who was already there. The argument failed to quiet my rage. God loves us all just like his own children," Bessie said. "If God loves me, why did he make my father die?" Bessie said that I would understand someday, but she was only partly right. That afternoon, though I couldn't have phrased it this way then, I decided that God was a lot less interested in people than anybody in Morrisonville was willing to admit. That day I decided that God was not entirely to be trusted. After that, I never cried again with any real conviction, nor expected much of anyone's God except indifference, nor loved deeply without fear that it would cost me dearly in pain. At the age of 5, I had become a skeptic. End of the quote from Russell Baker. So let me conclude by noting that however prevalent the superficial motives are for being an unbeliever, there still remain, in many instances, the deep and disturbing psychological sources as well. However easy it may be to state the hypothesis of the defective father, we must not forget the difficulty, the pain, and the complexity that lie behind each individual case. And for those whose atheism has been conditioned by a father who died, who rejected, who denied, who hated, who manipulated, or who physically or sexually abused them, there must be understanding and compassion. Certainly for a child to be forced in this way to hate his own father, or even to despair because of his father's weakness, is a great tragedy. After all, the child only wants to love his father and to have a father who loves him back. For any unbeliever whose atheism is grounded in such experiences, the believer blessed by God's love should pray, most especially, that ultimately they will both meet in heaven, meet and embrace and experience great joy. If so, perhaps the former atheist will experience even more joy than the believer, for the atheist will have that extra increment that comes from his surprise at finding himself surrounded by joy in, of all places, his father's house. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. You got a yellow card when you came in, and we're going over this every night, but if you'll fill that out if you're here for the first time, or if you're here for a repeat time, we appreciate you filling that out again, and there will be someone to take it as you leave out the door after the question and answer session. Don't forget we have books and tapes down front right up here, and we hope you'll stop by there and check those out. Also, check the box on your yellow card if you want some information. We have an article by a former atheist, and if you would like that information, please leave. Check that box, and we'll get that information to you. There are two microphones in each aisle for a question and answer, and please make the questions brief so we can get as many people as possible, and I'll leave the floor to you.
Okay, let's see what we... This mic? This one's still working? Yes.
I just have a question. I agree. My sister's an atheist. And when you're talking about the effect of father's hypothesis, I was wondering if that could be the effect of mother hypothesis, the effect of family hypothesis, because a lot of the with your example today with father included some kind of bad thing, or a lot of bad things that make good people.
Well, the thing that might be in, well, okay, can it be, in general it's the defective father. The question is, how was the father defective? In some cases where the mother is viewed or in fact is harsh, abusive, or manipulative, or rejecting, or whatever, the father is blamed for not interfering, for not protecting the child. The father is seen as weak and wimpy, or as somehow or other distant and withdrawn while this goes on. And it becomes hard for somebody psychologically then to view God as strong and loving when their experience in the human realm has been with a father who was weak and unloving. In addition to this, that could be related to the fact that mother was pretty abusive too, and if both parents were religious and wanted the child to go to church, and the child felt hurt and rejected and abused in the family, that she would reject everything connected with the family. I do think a lot of religious people are sometimes guilty of harm that is, therefore, you know, has effects of the kind that I've mentioned. Yes?
Yes, sir, I have a question. My sister is also an atheist, and recently she experienced a tragedy that, as you were saying, that God was bad and attacking good people. And I think her recent conversion to atheism is part of her way of finding a rational explanation for why things happened the way it did. Could this be part of a healing process for her to feel like a shell around herself and for protection?
It would be part of a psychological way to cope with it, and thus it might be protective in some ways. Whether there might not be better ways to seek out a solution to that problem, I don't know. I think there might be. But it would serve the psychological function of protecting her from the meaning. I mean, she presumably lost somebody she loved. And the result of that is, how could this is the experience of the problem of evil, and therefore how can there be a good God? But an atheism is one way of reacting to it, like my wife did, but there it was associated with her father's own behavior quite directly. I don't know in this case whether it is. It might be a slightly different kind of response, actually, the one you've mentioned.
Thank you. One more thing. Is there a way, the right way, to show that God is loving without mentioning it? If I mention it to her, she would immediately turn away from that subject and immediately receive that. Is there any right way to show her that God is loving?
Yes. Be loving yourself. Be the image of what you believe God is. And don't argue, don't debate, don't push. Just, if, for example, even when a person, in a different but related situation, when a person is grieving through the loss of someone they love, it's very hard to, you know, there's no way to explain death to such a person in a way that it'll be helpful. What will be helpful is to be with them and to be supportive. Help them do things, distract them a little bit from, you know, and just daily loving help. So be the image of the God you want her to return to. That means patient, don't push. Yes. To some extent. And what I would like to say is this. This is to help us understand some of the psychological reasons why people reject God. It's my belief that if you have a kind of unbiased, open psychology, that God's presence will come spontaneously to you, and the belief in God will. But that's my assumption. I see it in the lives of children who are, and so forth. But speaking rationally, I want to say this. Let's use an analogy. If you bring a case into court because you think somebody has harmed you, obviously you have a personal motivation in why you are bringing the case to court. It's assumed that the two parties in the court case have a self-interest, have a psychological motivation behind it. The problem to be decided in the court by the jury and the judge is whether your case is valid. So the atheist may have reasons for rejecting God of the kind I've mentioned, but that does not invalidate the logic of his arguments. It may help you understand him personally. But arguments of a rational kind are not dependent upon why the person might have wanted to propose them or to believe them. The ad hominem argument 100 or more years ago was considered intrinsically unacceptable. Whatever the reasons are for your being an atheist, let's listen to the atheist's actual, you know, arguments carefully. But why I'm bringing this up is that for many decades, the believer has been the person who's been primarily criticized from this point of view. And what I want to do is say, let's take the reasons for our belief off the table and look at the evidence and try to make each of us as unbiased as possible. Don't believe in God because you have a deep psychological need of a kind for, you know, for Santa Claus. And don't reject God because your old man was an SOB. That's what I'm trying to say on the rational issue. I do believe when the biases are minimal and you look at the world, God's presence is visible in the sense, in the beauty and in the character of what life is like. And you often see this in children. Because Freud's, what I did was, I didn't use Freud's theory, I said this. I said, if you are a psychoanalyst, if you believe in psychoanalysis, and lots of people do, all right? If you believe in it, most of them now seem to be in departments of literature of some kind. But, I think, not, but there's some, but if you believe in psychoanalysis, there's a psychoanalytic reason for understanding why we should be atheists. All right? Second, his argument about the projection theory is not a Freudian argument per se. It goes back to Feuerbach, and many people use that to criticize believers today. Belief in God is just, you never grew up, right? I'm pretty sure every believer here has heard it. You're just a kid. You know, you haven't, grow up, come to college and grow up. Actually, I see atheism as not childish, but I see it as adolescent. Three stages in life. Childhood, adolescence, and adulthood. But anyway. So I say, if you are a psychoanalyst, this is what follows as an argument. Second, my major argument, of course, was that of the defective father, and this has nothing to do with psychoanalysis. Well, look, that's the look. I understand Nietzsche. Nietzsche rejected God. Yeah, but he also rejected God. Well, you missed my point. My point, all right? My point, like, what? My point is that we've been criticized as believers for a long time because of our psychology. All right? And what I'm saying is that argument isn't valid, and the best way to show it is to start predicting unbelievers on the basis of their psychology. Nietzsche was preoccupied with his father all his life. Everyone admits he had a kind of father complex, and so did Jean-Paul Sartre. They were fighting with him all the time. Now, I would propose that's why they believed what they did. Nevertheless, their arguments have to be dealt with at a rational level. That was my point. Cognitive psychology is what I was... I don't know why you're saying that, because, first of all, cognitive psychology I was trained in, and it's not rational either, but that's another topic. But
what you say is not
observable.
You're trying to draw a correlation between something
that can be totally unrelated. I don't understand. Make your point a little clearer. I'm trying to make mine precise. I am saying that these arguments can be made about the origin of a belief, and whether that belief is belief in God or belief of an atheist kind makes no difference. Both of them are ad hominem arguments. We have to deal with the evidence. But for 100 years, the only one of the only side of that argument that's been effective, the only side that's been effective, has been the sides that's used it against the believer. That's the only argument that's been used. There's no psychology of atheism of the kind I've outlined here anywhere. Everywhere, believers are put down with an argument that, as you have made very clear, is not rational. Over here now. Right.
We use that much anymore. In large part, that's probably due recently to a lot of things that have come out in the last probably century, last decade. The problem with the method
Right.
This is the board that's in that commencement of the day, but also having a large number of single-sex families. Where do you see religion going in the next, the millennium coming? Where do you see that in the place of single-sex families and single-parent families, where there is not going to be father, not so much because of the father's fault, not so much that he died or killed himself, or some tragedy, but simply with his pastor? Where do you see atheism in the world?
Well, I would say, first of all, it's a social condition for creating atheism or at least skepticism on a large scale. Second, it's likely to create a need for father figures, particularly in the lives of the children who grow up in that environment. They may find that in a political figure. They may find it who knows where. But it's a need that's there that could be expressed in unpredictable ways. It's hard to say, but I would say it will be a need. I mean, it is a need that's there. They're going to look for father figures of all kinds, in politics, on television, a lot of places. And I'm making the point here in part to make us aware that that kind of motivation may be something that would be helpful in addressing children who come from that background. One way is to say, God's the father that you never had. And that's where you'll find it. And if it makes you seek out God, you are fortunate. You're fortunate. Okay, another question? Right. Can you give me an example of what situation you would want? Let's put the Freudian thing aside, but let's just take this hypothesis of the defective father. Right. Let me try to answer that. If we have a crisis in our culture today, I think most people would agree it's a crisis in the family. But the crisis in the family, when we talk about single-parent families, we really mean fatherless families. 90% of the time, 95%. It's fathers who have abandoned families, abandoned children. So really what we have is a crisis with fathers in this society. Fathers are not committing themselves. They're not identifying with raising their children. They're turning them over to the state or to whatever. The answer to this problem, as I said, I think it's going to raise a lot of people with a kind of implicit skepticism and atheism. The answer to this is for men, in simple language, to shape up. And what I mean by that is for men to be fathers again. And by being a father, I don't mean you necessarily are a natural father, you have natural children. A man can be a grandfather can be a father to a grandchild. A coach can be a father for a lot of the kids in his high school who don't have fathers. A lot of people can be, if you will, substitute fathers or alternate father figures. It begins at home, of course, and men have got to start shaping up and realizing if they're going to have children, there's a responsibility that goes with that, and that responsibility is something you better shape up with. And I think this is something, as I said, that men have to do, but I think they have to do it by themselves. I see signs that this may be happening in things like Promise Keepers and other movements of that kind. Whether this will spread and deal with our problem adequately, I don't know. But it's time for men it's as though we have three ways of being a man. You can be a macho, you can be a wimp, or you can be 50-50, you know, half the time one and half the time the other. Or you can be what I would call a responsible father, a servant leader, somebody who puts his masculinity in the service of other people. Normally your family, your children. We don't have any images of what kind of man like that is supposed to be found in America. We have very few stories about it. Very few. I mean, the first American story is Rip Van Winkle. Think about it. He runs off and with the boys and goes bowling and comes back 20 years later. That's the first American story. There's also Daniel Boone, you know, always going off into the wilderness. He came back one time after 2 years to discover his wife had a new child. So we need to find that the answer to this problem is to cease producing defective fathers. Yeah. Mostly biography. I didn't mention it, but I have a whole control group of the lives of theists. Where you Well, right, and the control group is made up of people like Pascal, no dummy, and a bunch of others, who were contemporaries. I had Bishop Butler, I had Wilberforce, and also his son. I have G.K. Chesterton, I have a whole, you know, who else do I have in there? I have Martin Buber, I have Bonhoeffer, and a whole bunch of other believers at the same time. And there you show very strong relationships to their fathers as being very important. And that's the control group. But what can you say? The only biographies that are written are of famous people. And, I mean, mostly. And so, That's if you wrote about somebody who wasn't famous, nobody would know who you were writing about. So I did write about these characters that many people have heard of and now begin to hear a little bit about their early life, which they didn't hear about before. Bertrand Russell's early life and who are some? I have Chateaubriand, I have de Tocqueville, and so on. There are a whole bunch of them. It's fun to look them up and try to find what you can. Yes. The practical psychology of that is that large numbers of black American males are becoming Muslims. That's the practical effect, that, and it's going on, and it's fairly substantial, and so on. I heard an African-American woman who was a Baptist who asked her husband to become a Muslim because she felt that Christianity wasn't adequate for men, and asked her husband to become a Muslim. Well, Scripture is very clear. You know, Jesus tells us the language that we're to use, but it's not surprising that if men are going to abandon their children, that this kind of psychology develops as a result of it. I mean, men have only themselves, in that sense, to blame. Yes. Thank you. I also believe that if you seek, you'll find. You may not find what you think you're going to find, but you'll find. And so seek, and you'll find. Yes. That were not answered?
They were not really answered. I believe the people that asked the questions sat down and sort of taken the answer.
Okay, well, what were the questions?
And basically, I see the main focus is for the belief that there is an intelligent creator that is God. The question is, what was basically for the multiple? I agree with where you're coming from. How do we know who that God is? How do we know whether there's a more than one God? And I just wanted to.
How do we know how do we know the nature of God at all?
Yeah, I wanted to bring that up just for the sake of here. Anyone that might be wondering,
on that I will only answer how I think of it. I'm not prepared. I see religion as rather like science or almost any other kind of activity. It's a mixture of experience or data gathering and intellectual reflection on the data. In religion, intellectual reflection on the data is called theology. A lot of what we have to know in any science, we go to somebody else to tell us. We go to an expert or somebody who's experienced and so forth. But in the final analysis, presumably experientially, it will be validated if we have to. In each of our own lives, we have one of the things that's going on in all of our lives, I assume, is religious experience on a daily basis of some kind. Sometimes it's pretty thin, sometimes it's pretty thick. But there's the experience of prayer, there's the experience of providence in one's own life. Sometimes there are very direct communications from God. Other times there are angels in our life in the form of other people who come and talk to us and tell us something, you know. So it's a mixture of experience, reflection on it, and continuing to seek. So that's my answer to somebody who really wants to find God, is really seek and you'll find. As I said, it's not clear what you'll find in advance. It may not be what you think, because often what we think is a preconceived notion of what God is like, and God will refuse to be preconceived in that way and will come at us from the blind side. Will come at us in an unexpected way. That's one of the signs that it was really God. It wasn't what you anticipated. It'll also be scary. And you'll realize how, or at least I do, I don't want to put motives in you, but it'll be scary, and you'll realize what a chicken you are. And then you'll begin to say, not whether God exists, you'll say, I know God exists, and I'm a little nervous about that. In fact, yeah. All right. Why Christ? As distinct from God as the issue. Well, from any other theistic religion, it's distinguished primarily by Christ. That would distinguish it from Islam and from Judaism. Well, I go where, I mean, I start seeking, and God has told me what I'm supposed to be. I don't know, it doesn't matter. I mean, I would start looking. You don't rationally decide I'm going to spend a year in Siam and a year in, in Mecca and a year over here and then sort of try to put it together. Presumably one assumption is God created you, gave you your parents, and put you here at the University of Georgia. For some purpose. Maybe you're not here. What? You're not from the University of Florida or something, are you? But, you know, you are here for some reason, and that therefore it's in this environment to find your faith. That doesn't necessarily, you know, it can still be, you don't know what this environment will be when you begin searching. But I would assume you don't have to start trying all the others. And the issue is Christ, and so then you have to ask, if God is already in your life, you say, all right, show me Jesus. If I'm, you know, show that to me if I am supposed to know. The difference between Christianity and other forms of theism is that Christ is the representation of God in our lives so that we can see how we are to live. And that's also scary. I mean, you hear a lot of people talking about how wonderful everything it is, but, you know, it is. But still, it's scary. Because the cross is very frightening. Who wants to be humiliated in public? Nobody I know. Even Jesus didn't want to be. As far as I know. But I mean, the stripping away of the self, the ego stripping, or whatever you want to call it, is very painful, and that's why it's scary, and that's why most of the time one dawdles. Sorry to go into all this. There's another question, I think, behind you. And oh, two more, or one over here. Yes. You're next. We go.
And the husband.